nodding and wagging slightly longer than one would expect before continuing.
I think she, Gwen, and that guy, that Martin, I think they are the ones who are trying to get rid of Britt. Yeah, yeah, it all makes sense.
Ida spread her arms wide and spun around, making sure that she had everyone's attention. She did.
Yeah, Gwen wanted Britt out of the way because she wanted that other wizard guy, the old one.
Philip, Gwen interrupted.
Yes, Philip. You liked Philip, didn't you? Yeah, and you knew that he and Britt the Younger were an item, so she had to go.
Gwen asked, more out of curiosity than any concern.
Why would Martin help?
Ida said.
Because he wanted you, right? I mean, it's obvious that he's into you. Obviously, he wanted Philip out of the way so he could have you to himself.
Gwen shook her head.
So you're saying that we killed Britt so I could have Philip, and we killed Philip so Martin could have me. That's stupid.
Ida said.
No stupider than the plan you say Nilo and I had.
Well,
Gwen said through gritted teeth.
I can't argue with that.
No, you can't,
Ida smirked.
But tell me this, Gwen asked. What about Ampix?
Ida asked,
what's an Ampix?
Gwen, speaking more to the gathered sorceresses than to Ida, said,
he's a guard who was in the room when Ida admitted her plan to Martin and me.
Well, clearly he'll back you two up because he's in on it too. He probably wants you as well.
Gwen was amazed.
You're saying that I killed Britt because I wanted Philip to myself, and that Martin and Ampix both helped me, killing Philip in the process because they both wanted me instead.
Ida shrugged, smugly. Gwen rolled her eyes.
Look, if we were just going to get rid of Philip along with Britt, then there's no point in getting rid of Britt in the first place. Also, even if that made sense, the plan you just laid out still leaves me, Martin, and Ampix here in Atlantis, so neither of them has me. The math doesn't work out.
Ida said,
oh, I don't know. Maybe you're into that kind of thing.
Gwen said,
if I were, then they'd have no reason to get rid of Philip.
Ida said,
look, it's your stupid plan. I can't explain it.
Louisa decided it was time to take back control of the meeting.
A lot of accusations have been made here, some plausible, some less so. I propose that we don't do anything rash until we've had time to talk to Martin, Nilo, and, what's his name?
Gwen said,
Ampix.
Louisa looked at Ida and said,
we'll talk to them. Then we'll do something rash. I further propose that I continue to refer to the guard in question as what's his name.
The wave of head nods and muttered affirmations made a vote unnecessary. Louisa opened her mouth to say something else, but was interrupted by a blinding flash of light coming from a gap in the buildings up near the rim of the city. All of the sorceresses looked up and saw fire, chaos, and panic. An instant later, loud, horrific sounds of screaming and explosions reached their ears.
What in God's name is that?
Louisa gasped. Gwen said,
the boys.
Every window, door, and alleyway that fed into the square was packed full of people craning their necks to see what would happen next. But the square itself appeared to be populated entirely by wizards and cobras. Nilo was there too, but nobody could see him because he and Martin were buried under the cobras. The wizards wore many different disguises. There were shaman, medicine men, philosophers, con men, holy men, magi, and magicians. But they were all, when you got down to it, wizards. And now they were acting like it. Once Vikram had finished producing the cobras, he joined the rest of the wizards in creating and maintaining the invisible walls that were holding the squirming mass of horror in place. The cobras were piled at least 10 feet deep, and where the force fields held them in, they formed a solid wall of slick, coiling blackness. Gilbert, still disguised as a tuxedoed mass of tentacles, asked Vikram,
what if the cobras bite him? We're not trying to kill anybody.
Vikram said,
oh, they're not actually poisonous. They're not even really snakes. They look and feel real, but all they do is slither around. They don't bite.
A small light spot appeared in the undulating wall of snake flesh. It grew and became recognizable as a hand. A second hand joined it, pushing against the invisible force field. Then Nilo's face became clear, contorted both by the pressure of being pressed against the force field and by the horror of what was doing the pressing. Nilo struggled and scrambled and clambered his way to the top of the pile, which looked a bit like tall marsh grass swaying in the wind. Only instead of grass, it was hooded cobras, all poised as if ready to strike. Gilbert was so amazed by the sight of Nilo fighting his way to freedom that he didn't even think to extend the force field until Nilo was already vaulting over the top of it. Nilo landed clumsily on the ground between Gilbert and Sid, neither of whom made any move to stop him, as they were busy holding back a wall of snakes. They knew the snakes weren't real, but they didn't have time to think. They were acting on instinct, and the avoid being buried under an avalanche of cobras instinct is pretty strong. Nilo rose awkwardly to his feet, looked at the wall of snakes behind him, looked at the monsters on either side of him, and ran away from all three of them as fast as he could. Sid shouted, "Someone stop him!" Nilo was running toward the open end of the square that led out to empty space and a spectacular view of the city. If he reached the edge, he could jump. As steep as the bowl was at this level, the tops of the buildings on the next level down could probably be only 30 feet or so down. He would have to vault over the railing, but he could survive that jump, and then would have an excellent chance of escaping. John, the Chinese wizard, heard Gilbert's call, and in one smooth motion redirected his energies from maintaining the wall to shooting some sort of glowing energy ball toward Nilo. The ball of red light passed through him as if he weren't there, continued straight out into the empty expanse of the city's airspace, then flashed a blinding red light. When the light died, in its place, suspended in midair, was a massive Chinese dragon. Its body, at least 50 feet long, undulated through the air like a gymnast's ribbon, but at the front end, instead of a 14-year-old Ukrainian girl with a stick, there was a head like that of a lion, but much larger and much less sleepy. Its claws looked like daggers, its eyes looked like hatred itself, and it made a beeline for Nilo, who scrabbled to an undignified stop, shrieked, and darted away to his right. John would have found it quite gratifying, if he'd seen it. Unfortunately, he had lowered his force field to create the dragon, and as such had been buried under an avalanche of snakes. The dragon changed direction to follow Nilo, who ran a full, panicked lap of the cobra pile until he emerged on the other side of the square with an unobstructed run to the open air and freedom again. Luckily, John had shown the way, and the Incan shaman at the other side of the pile had paid attention. The Incan dropped his force field and reached toward the open air. In the space between Nilo and the railing, a mounted conquistador appeared, glowing like a fake ghost in an episode of Scooby-Doo. Steam burst from the ghostly horse's nostrils as it reared up on its hind legs and flailed menacingly with its hooves. The rider leveled a flare-fronted musket at Nilo, but Nilo had already altered his course to run another lap of the pile. As he ran around the backside of the square, each wizard he passed abandoned the wall and did something to add to his problems. By the time he emerged again on the other side of the square, he was pursued by the dragon, the conquistador, a three-headed wolf, a stone golem, and a small pack of vicious chihuahuas. The cobra wall had also unraveled behind him, giving the impression that he was fleeing from a non-stop wave of deadly snakes. As he again sprinted toward the railing, and, Nilo hoped, freedom, he was passed by another bolt of energy that struck the railing and exploded into a wall of solid flames that filled his entire field of vision. He stopped dead in his tracks, shielding his eyes from the light and his face from the searing heat. His shoulders sagged, and he turned to face his tormentors. He saw the people of his city, his people, watching from every available vantage point, waiting to see how he would be tortured next. He saw the wizards, the monsters, and the tiny yapping dogs, all waiting for him to make his next move, and all standing ankle-deep in the pile of snakes, except for the chihuahuas, who were standing on the surface of the snakes. It was almost impossible, but Nilo managed to keep his fear in check. For an instant, the central mass of cobras emitted a glow, as if they were piled on top of a theatrical spotlight that had been quickly turned on and then off again. Then the pile began to swell, bulging and pulsing outward. A circular wave of wriggling snakes rolled outward like a ripple in a pond, as a swirling mass of what appeared to be small silver boxes broke the surface of the pile. The boxes coalesced into a larger version of the recognizable form of a crouching wizard, Martin, who had finally managed to find his staff. Giant Martin rose to his full height, cobras rolling off of his shoulders and back like rain. He planted his gigantic staff on the ground with a sound like two wrecking balls colliding. He looked down, surveying the scene. He saw the fearsome creatures, the wall of flame, the large audience, and the International Task Force of Wizards, all clearly ready for action, standing in what he had to admit were mostly bad imitations of kung fu poses. Martin took this all in, then opened his giant mouth, and in a voice so deep and so loud that you could feel it in your viscera, he said, "See? This is more like it!" With that, the last of Nilo's self-control disappeared. His mind was wiped clean of all rational thought. All he knew was that he wanted to get away. He turned, screaming, and leapt through the wall of fire. He emerged on the other side, hair and clothes smoldering, and fell 30 feet to the roof of a building below. He landed badly, rolling on his side. He speed-crawled to the edge and then slid over. He fell another 20 feet to street level. He landed on his back, groaning, just in time to see Giant Martin burst through the wall of fire with his legs tucked up under him, one hand in a fist, and his staff held out before him like a sword. All of the hideous creatures and all of the wizards who had created them followed Martin through the wall of fire. Most flew under their own power, but the distinguished gentleman from China rode his dragon. Martin made a 3-point landing, taking up most of the street. Nilo ran like he'd never run before, literally. In his terror, he'd forgotten all grace and technique and was shambling like a toddler, arms flapping uselessly. His hair and the heavy fabric of his kilt had stopped smoldering, but his netting shirt burst into actual flame. Luckily for him, there was very little of it to burn, and the fire was mostly light and flash with very little heat. Still, Martin caught up to him in one massive stride, more a short flight than a single step, and kindly put out the fire by mashing Nilo to the ground with the flat of his hand. Nilo yelped piteously as Martin grasped him around the waist in his giant fist and lifted him up 2.5 stories to Martin's eye level. In truth, Martin was located in the giant's torso, but lifting him up to the head was better showbiz. Nilo pushed and struggled and beat at the immense fingers with his fists, but Martin did not feel it, so it had no effect. Nilo screamed insults and curses, ranted and raved, and made specific threats about what he'd do when he got loose. Martin wanted to squash him like a bug. He had tried to kill Gwen and Martin and Ampix. He'd beaten Martin mercilessly and had tried to kill Gwen. He may have killed Philip and Britt, both of her. And what made it all worse? He'd tried to kill Gwen. Martin wanted to squeeze him until he popped, but he didn't. He showed some restraint. Instead, he raised the hand that was holding his immense staff and gently flicked Nilo's head with his index finger. Nilo's head flew to the side as if he'd been slapped. Martin looked to the assembled wizards, who along with their various creations were hovering around him like planets orbiting a star. He said, "Thanks for the help, everyone! That was great!" Martin's eye was caught by Gilbert and Sid, who had not yet taken the trouble to revert from their monster forms. He looked at Gilbert's wings and tentacles and said, "Cthulhu, obviously." Gilbert's face tentacles parted, and he replied, "Obviously." Martin turned to Sid and asked, "Are you Feklar, guardian of the Klingon afterlife?" Gilbert slobbered,
"As envisioned by Ardra in the Star Trek The Next Generation episode, Devil's Due."
Martin laughed and asked,
"How is it that we're not friends?"
Gilbert said,
"Maybe in our time you're just a jerk."
Sid added,
"Or maybe we are friends, and Gil and I have just been messing with you."
A distant voice shouted,
Hey, Martin!
Martin turned, and back at the railing that marked the edge of the public square where all the action had occurred, amongst the throng of Atlanteans, he saw Ampix waving his arms. Martin covered the space between them in one long, gliding step, standing on one of the rooftops beneath the railing.
Ampix, are you okay?
Ampix said,
Yeah, my knee hurts, but it could have been much worse. I see you caught him.
Martin said,
Yeah, always knew he would in the end.
He lifted Nilo up for the crowd to see, like a child showing off his favorite toy.
Look, everyone! It's Nilo! Say hello to Nilo!
A surprising number of people actually did yell,
Hi, Nilo!
So, what do we do now?
Ampix asked.
Go find Gwen, I guess.
Can I come?
Martin said,
Sure.
Then looked at his hands. One was holding his staff, the other was holding Nilo. He couldn't really let go of either. He looked perplexed for a moment, then jammed Nilo into one of his armpits and stretched out his now free hand to carry Ampix. 34. The sorceresses watched the distant lights and listened to the horrific noises coming from the upper ring, as if it were some bizarre fireworks show. Most of it had been just a little too distant to make out from their vantage point, near the lowest part of the city. It was mainly distant shrieking noises and weird, faint glows, but the Chinese dragon was large enough to get everyone's attention. Then the wall of fire held their attention. The tiny-looking, normal-sized man bursting through the wall, pursued by a giant silver wizard, made for a pretty satisfying finale for everyone except Ida. Gwen knew who the giant silver wizard was, and when he started standing around casually with what appeared to be a human being clamped helplessly in his hand, she knew what that meant. Gwen asked Louisa,
Mind if I send them a signal to come down here?
Louisa said,
Knock yourself out. It should be interesting to hear what they have to say.
Gwen poked and swiped at the air in front of her, then traced an arrow shape, and in the sky directly above her position, a huge, blinking blue arrow appeared directly overhead. The sorceresses had a chuckle when they saw the silver giant notice, then point at the arrow. Martin placed Ampix on the back of the Chinese dragon, along with John, the dragon's rider. Martin retrieved Nilo from his underarm and slowly flew down to the center of the city. All of the wizards who had assisted him followed. As they flew, Martin heard Vikram shout,
I put out a call to all the delegates I know to meet us at the arrow and pass the message along. Whatever happens, I think it would be good to have plenty of witnesses.
Soon, Giant Martin touched down in the park, just beyond the railing of Brit the Elder's patio. He looked down to the sorceresses, said,
Ladies?
And touched the squirming and protesting Nilo to the brim of his hat as a sign of greeting. It only took a moment for Martin to lose the undivided attention of his audience. He looked over his shoulder and was a bit disgusted by what he saw. He knew the Chinese wizard was riding his dragon down, giving Ampix a lift in the process, but he hadn't expected the Incan to bring the ghost conquistador along. And he'd assumed that Gilbert and Sid would go ahead and ditch their Cthulhu and Feklar disguises. He certainly hadn't expected to see winged chihuahuas flying in behind him. They had Nilo in custody. There was no need for all of this shock and awe. But then Martin remembered that they'd been able to see that many of the sorceresses had gathered at their destination, and Martin realized that these guys would not choose to turn off their most impressive spells before the ladies got a chance to see them.
I guess I'm lucky that Vikram didn't bring the snakes,
Martin thought bitterly. There's nothing a show-off hates more than a competing show-off. Vikram's call had been more successful than expected. Most of the city had become aware of the chaos Martin and Nilo had started, and when the call to the delegates went out saying that the danger was probably over, but the interesting bit was not, they all came running, or rather, flying. Less than a minute after Gwen had sent up her arrow, every magic user in Atlantis was gathered together, the sorceresses on Brit's raised patio and the delegates in the park below. Rather than try to get everyone up to speed herself, Gwen simply asked Ampix to tell everyone what had happened when they confronted Ida. He stood, surrounded by his audience, and explained the whole thing. Gwen was betting that he, as a naive, non-magical type, would be believed more readily than she or Martin, and by the time he finished, she could see that she'd been right. Louisa thanked Ampix, then turned to Ida and asked,
"Would you like to say anything in your defense?"
Ida started to say something, but she saw the looks on the faces of the sorceresses, her former friends, and realized that more talking was not the solution to her problems. The jig was up, all the way up. Any attempt at a defense would just be perceived as a new crime, like a child who steals a cookie, then lies to his parents about it. She simply shook her head no.
"And how about you, Nilo, is it? Anything to say for yourself?"
Louisa shouted. Nilo shouted,
"How dare you question her? How dare you question either of us? She is your president! She is your rightful ruler! You should defer to her as she defers to me, her man!"
Louisa said,
"Interesting."
"Silence, woman! You've forgotten your place! You've all forgotten your place! This whole city you've built is a perversion, and I've tolerated it for about as long as I can. You have forgotten your place. You are women. Women! You are here to serve the needs of men!"
With commendable calm, Louisa said,
"Women built this city and invited you to live here. We rule the city and make sure everything works. We bend the laws of time and space. We do that. We women!"
"Yes!"
Nilo said triumphantly, as if she had made his point for him.
"That is how you serve us. That is your place. To make a peaceful and pleasant place for your men while we do the important work."
Louisa said,
"You do what we want you to."
Nilo sneered derisively.
"And that's what is wrong. We should do what we want."
"While we do everything else?"
Louisa asked. Nilo said,
"If that's what your man wants, always remember, you are here to serve men. It is not natural for men to do women's bidding."
Louisa said,
"Then you're not going to like this. Martin, please shut him up."
Martin said,
"Yes, ma'am."
Then flicked Nilo's head again and sent him back to the giant armpit for a timeout. Nilo's legs kicked furiously, but he was effectively silenced. Louisa stepped forward and in a loud, confident voice said,
"I am not in charge here. Nobody has elected me. I have no official rank. I only step forward to organize things because I saw that someone had to. While we are on Atlantean ground, the crimes committed here have affected one of our guests as well. So for this matter, I personally think the delegate should have an equal say in how we proceed. Does anyone object?"
The silence was long and pronounced enough to be a clear answer.
"Okay,"
Louisa continued.
"Good. Delegates, rest assured that Ida and Nilo will be punished, and we can certainly discuss who will determine what that punishment will be. But before that, I think we need to find out definitively what happened to the wizard Philip and the sorceresses Brit the Elder and Brit the Younger. Does anyone object to that?"
Brit the Elder raised her hand and said,
"I object to you referring to me as if I were two separate people, but I'm willing to let that go for now."
Louisa said,
"Fair enough. Thanks, Brit."
Then she, along with almost everybody else, spent the next few moments silently freaking out and listening to Ida curse. Brit the Elder smiled and said,
"Ida, if I didn't know any better, I'd think you weren't happy to see me."
Ida's unbecoming anger faded and was quickly replaced with an equally unbecoming expression of hope.
"No, Brit, on the contrary, I'm very happy to see you. All these people thought Nilo had killed you and that I'd helped, but the fact that you're here proves that he didn't do it."
"Ida, dear, the fact that I still live only really proves that Nilo didn't succeed in killing me. I am living proof that he failed. Usually I say a miss is as good as a mile, but in this case I'm willing to give him full credit for having tried his hardest. As for you, you tried to help him, and you succeeded."
Ida cried,
"But I didn't—"
"Yes, you did,"
Brit the Elder said, interrupting.
"I didn't think—"
"No, you didn't," Brit agreed.
"I was sure he couldn't—"
"But you were happy to let him try."
"But then where—"
Younger me and Philip are fine. We'll get to that. Don't jump ahead.
Ida whined.
But I didn't do...
Finally, Britt the Elder had enough. She snapped,
I know what you did. I know exactly what you both did. I saw the whole thing, twice, from two different angles. I lived through what your houseboy did to me. Then I had over a century to think about it. Then I got to spend the last week watching you do it all over again. So don't talk to me about what you did and didn't do, because at this point I know it all better than you do. I know what you did. I know what all these good people have done, and I know how we will all decide to punish you.
Ida gave a sickly smile and said,
Really? Do you know about this?
She hastily traced a shape in the air with broad, slashing gestures, shouted,
Evac! Evac! Evac!
And she and Nilo both disappeared. Britt said,
As a matter of fact, I did.
She turned around to address the throng of magic users who surrounded her, both on her patio and on the turf below.
Don't worry, everyone. I know exactly where they went. I'm gonna let them have one more happy night together, thinking they got away with it, just to make it that much more painful for them when they're caught. When they wake up tomorrow morning, they'll find me, younger me, and Philip waiting at the foot of their bed. And believe me, the look on their faces will be priceless.
Louisa asked,
But what if they get away from you?
They won't.
But how can you be sure?
Louisa persisted.
Like I said,
Britt explained.
When I was younger, I came along. Besides, you know full well that thanks to the file, there's nowhere they can possibly go where we wouldn't easily find them.
Gwen spoke up.
There might be a problem there. The file's been locked down. Martin and I both tried to access it from several different places, and it's been password protected.
Britt smiled.
First of all, thank you, Gwen, for trying.
She raised her voice so all could hear.
Thank you to everyone for having helped bring Nilo and Ida to justice. But particularly, I'd like to thank Ampix, Gwen, and Martin. And to Gwen and Martin, I also want to apologize. I'm the one who locked you out of the file. Think of it as a proof of concept for things we'll be discussing later in the week. Besides, I couldn't have you bringing Philip and me back prematurely, could I? Speaking of which...
Britt the Elder swiped her finger through the air, scrolling through options only she could see. Finally, she jabbed at the air before her, and Britt the Younger and Philip materialized. They were both wearing t-shirts, shorts, and sneakers. Britt had a pair of black mouse ears with Britt embroidered on the back in gold thread. Philip had a similar set of ears that said, Phil. To the other sorceresses, Britt the Elder had always seemed a little aloof, a bit above them. They all adored and respected her, but from a distance. Britt the Younger had always been more approachable, so they approached her from all sides, making it clear that they were happy she was back and was all right. Philip looked out over the assembled wizards, nodded, and said,
Hey, guys!
Some of the wizards waved. All of them muttered some variation on the phrase, Hi, good to see you. While the sorceresses were greeting Britt the Younger to within an inch of her life, Gwen caught a glimpse of Britt the Elder watching them, and she could have sworn that Britt the Elder looked jealous. But then Britt the Elder made a few quick swipes at the air, raised her hand, and projected a force field over the sorceresses just in time to stop the hail of arrows Nilo had created during his battle with the wizards, arrows that had fallen uselessly to the ground before, but were drawn to Britt the Younger as soon as she reappeared. With that, Britt the Elder no longer looked jealous. Martin reverted to his normal size and appearance and went to join Philip. They shook hands and mumbled some bland greetings, expressing their feelings by making an obvious effort to ignore them, as was their way.
So, what happened? Martin asked.
Philip said,
We went through the portal and immediately found ourselves underwater. We sank for a few seconds. I couldn't do any magic without my staff. We should really do something about that, by the way.
Martin said,
I've come to the same conclusion. Go on.
Well, I realized that Britt couldn't do any magic with me holding on to her hand, so I let go, and just as she started to work a spell, we teleported again. We found ourselves in a hotel room. We coughed and sputtered for a bit, then we realized that Britt the Elder was standing there watching us.
What did she say?
Martin asked.
She offered us towels. Then Britt yelled at her until she got tired. Then she explained that you and Gwen would sort things out and that everything would work out for the best. But for that to happen, the three of us had to disappear for a little while. How long have we been gone?
Martin said, hours. You disappeared into the wall this morning.
But why? How long have you been gone?
A week. Britt the Elder did two great things for us. She got us a week at Walt Disney World during Epcot's grand opening, and she left us alone to enjoy it. The only catch was that we couldn't contact anyone. We had to let events here unfold the way she remembered.
Did you stay on property? Martin asked.
Philip said,
The Polynesian Resort.
Nice, Martin said.
It was. It gave us something to do together that didn't require us to just focus on our relationship problems the whole time. Real problems stick around, of course, but the nice thing about the unimportant made-up problems is that if you ignore them long enough, they really will just go away.
Martin smiled. I'm glad you two had a good time. I've spent the afternoon arguing with Gwen, grieving my best friend, and being savagely beaten in front of a large audience.
Philip said,
I'm sorry I missed it.
Martin believed him. Britt the Elder raised her hand to get everyone's attention. When that didn't work, she cleared her throat. When that didn't work, she said, Pardon me? When that didn't work, she summoned a lightning bolt that struck her, temporarily blinding, deafening, and terrifying the whole group.
I apologize, she said as the wizards and sorceresses tried to compose themselves. All these dragons, monsters, and giants sort of got me in the mood. Anyway, I believe we've all had enough excitement for one night. I move that we adjourn for the evening, then reconvene the summit in the morning at the usual time. I suggest all sorceresses attend as well. I think all will agree that we have pressing business to deal with, and that we are now prepared to deal with it in a manner we were unable to before today. Together. That's not to say that there will not be difficulty, she said. While we are all smiles today, I know that tomorrow many of you will not be happy with me, because, to be honest, I have manipulated you all. I know this because I remember it.
She gestured to Britt the Younger, who clearly still did not enjoy being used as a prop by her older self.
See, Britt the Elder continued, you can tell from the look on my face that even I am not happy with me. Oh, more so by the second, it would appear.
Everyone looked to Britt the Younger to see how angry she looked. Britt the Younger looked around, angrily. Everyone quickly looked away. Britt the Elder said,
Anyway, as I said, tomorrow we start the real work of this summit, deciding on a punishment for Ida and Nilo, setting up a mechanism for all of us time travelers to govern ourselves fairly, and making the hard decisions necessary to ensure that nothing this stupid and pointless ever happens again.
35. The open-air cafe was busy, full of Atlanteans and more than a few delegates enjoying their last meal in town before going home, now that the summit had ended. Ampix sat alone at a table for several minutes before Martin and Gwen arrived, both looking terrible. Ampix stood as they approached. Martin smiled and winced simultaneously, a move that is almost impossible unless you're hungover, in which case it is difficult to avoid.
Amp, Martin said. I see the knee's better.
Ampix shook Martin's hand, hugged Gwen, and said,
Yes, it's like nothing ever happened. That Louisa's a great doctor. It's a shame you had to make her president.
Gwen said,
Don't worry. She'll still be spending most of her time as a doctor. Being president of Atlantis is a part-time job.
And besides, Martin said, she goes up for re-election in a year, just like the chancellor. And both jobs are limited to only two consecutive terms, so that should ensure lots of turnover in the Council of Three.
Ampix said,
There's a lot I don't understand about how you all do things, but one of them is why you still call it the Council of Three when there are four people in it.
Gwen said,
Well, after a lot of arguing, mostly from Philip, it was decided that the Brits counted as one person, so they only get one vote.
Yep,
Martin said.
Between that and the fact that the Chancellor has to be a non-sorceress, voted into the job by the non-magical citizens of the city, I suspect things will be a little different around here.
Yeah, though the sorceresses still outnumber us on the council by 2-1, Ampik said, while we outnumber them out here by over 100-1.
Yeah, Martin allowed. I said a little different, not very different.
Ampix leaned in and lowered his voice.
Look, they don't tell us a lot about what you've been doing in there. What ended up happening with Ida and Nilo?
Gwen said,
part of why you haven't heard is that we didn't really do anything until yesterday. Dealing with them was the last official act of the summit. Philip and the Brits went and retrieved them, as Brit the Elder said, the morning after they escaped, and dragged them in front of the summit. We gave them one last opportunity to justify their actions, listened while they failed to do it, then we punished them.
Ampix clearly wasn't satisfied with that answer, so Martin elaborated.
They were both stripped of all powers. Nilo was banished from Atlantis for life. He's back in the little fishing village he came from. I'm told he always hated it there, so that's nice. Ida was sent back where she originally came from, too. You realize that none of us are really from here, right?
Ampix nodded.
Okay.
Martin continued.
Anyway, like I said, she was stripped of all powers, including her immortality, and was sent back to where she came from, never to return.
That's it?
Ampix asked.
Banishment? That's all the punishment they get?
Gwen explained.
When you know what's possible, what you could do, where you could go, how long you could live, believe me, Ampix, knowing that you had all of that and that you squandered it because you wanted just a little more, that's enough punishment for almost any crime.
But enough about punishment, Martin said.
Ampix, let's talk about rewards. You helped us. You helped me. And for that, we've all decided that you should be rewarded.
Ampix said,
I really didn't do much.
Martin said, that's true, but the point is you did something, and you could have been killed doing it. You helped me figure things out. You went with us to confront Ida, not knowing what she might do, and you tried to stop Nilo from pounding me into a puddle, even though it would have been easy for him to kill you.
I wouldn't say easy.
Very easy, Ampix. Anyway, we all discussed it, and we can't give you powers or immortality. But if you're careful and avoid doing anything too stupid, you will live a long life, and you will be healthy until the day you die. Also, if you like, you've been offered a position as Brit the Elder's personal servant.
Really?
Ampix said, clearly very grateful and impressed.
Brit the Elder.
He pictured it for a long moment, smiling broadly. Then he asked,
doesn't she have a whole team of servants?
Yes, and she still will. They'll continue to do pretty much all of the work. Yours will mostly be a ceremonial position. Nice work, if you can get it.
Will I be expected to...
No,
Gwen and Martin said in unison. You will not.
Okay,
Ampix said.
I won't be expected to, but, will I...
No, they repeated. You will not.
Fine,
Ampix said.
I understand. That's not part of the deal. At least not for now. But who knows what the future holds.
Gwen said,
Brit the Elder does, and she wanted us to make it clear to you that your services in the bedroom will not be required, not now or ever.
Ampix looked disappointed. Martin said,
I don't think you're quite understanding what we're telling you. Brit has very limited need of a personal servant. Your duties will consist entirely of light cleaning and attending the occasional dinner party.
The sort of work women are ill-suited for,
Ampix said.
Yeah, whatever, Martin said. Anyway, that's all you have to do, and in return you have income and a place of your own to live in for life, and you can pursue any woman you like, sorceress or not. The more he thought about that, the more Ampix liked it. There would be a major change in the way he approached women. Instead of trying to use his physical assets to attract someone of higher status who could take care of him, he would be using his ability to take care of others to attract someone of equal status. It would take a while to get used to, but Martin and Gwen thought he'd figure it out. The three of them made pleasant conversation until breakfast was done, then exchanged thank yous and goodbyes. As he shook Martin's hand, Ampix said,
I guess I won't see you again.
Nonsense, Martin said. There's another summit in 10 years. And also,
he looked at Gwen, who nodded.
I plan to come back for visits from time to time.
Ampix looked at Martin, then at Gwen, Then he laughed, the kind of laugh that said he knew exactly what was going to happen, while at the same time making it much less likely that what he thought would happen would. Gwen and Martin took their leave of Ampix and walked through the streets of Atlantis like two people who had some place to go, but were in no hurry to get there. After far too little walking and far too brief a lift ride for their liking, they arrived at their destination, Britt the Elder's patio, where, to Martin's surprise, they were immediately invited inside. Britt the Elder's quarters looked very similar to Britt the Younger's, what with the Scandinavian-inspired crystalline furniture and the lack of clutter. The primary difference was that there was no giant window onto the ocean. Because her home was so low in the bowl of the city, having a transparent glass wall was not an option. Instead, she had windows built into the walls that were constructed of modified portals, which allowed light through but nothing else, and in only one direction. Because of this, while her apartment was at the very bottom of the city, it commanded views from the top of the tallest building on the rim. Britt the Elder stood to welcome Gwen and Martin. Britt the Younger and Philip remained on the couch, holding hands. Martin saw Philip's hard-sided brown Samsonite suitcase sitting on the floor next to his own black fabric flight attendant special. Britt the Elder said,
"Martin, it's such a shame to see you go, but it's not forever, and besides, we did get a lot accomplished, didn't we?"
"A bit too much, if you ask me,"
Philip grumbled. Britt the Younger beamed at him and said,
"We don't have to ask you, dear. Everybody knows how you feel about it."
"Well, I'll keep repeating it until someone listens," Philip said.
"We have listened to you, Philip. You gave a speech in front of the entire summit, and everybody listened."
"If you were really listening, you wouldn't have voted against me."
"Or," Martin offered, "maybe we voted against you because we were listening."
Britt the Elder tried to calm things down, saying,
"Philip, I never said my proposal was without its problems."
"It's not without problems. It's all problems. It's a cluster of problems packed so tightly together that it appears to be one big problem. I mean, the technical problems involved in password protecting all known instances of the file."
"All of which I've already solved," Britt the Elder said.
"Pale in comparison," Philip continued, "to the logistical problems of finding every instance of the file that every wizard and sorceress found and used to come back here, then password protecting them, but removing the protection just before that instance was found in the first place, and putting it back just after the time traveler in question was told about the plan. Even saying it out loud is a confusing nightmare, let alone trying to implement it."
"But,"
Britt the Elder said patiently,
"we have many very smart people working on it, and we have literally all the time in the world to work it out."
Martin said,
"I don't know why you're complaining. Thanks to your forethought as chairman, our colony is one of the few that had a census of all of our people and where they found the file ready to go. You should be proud."
"Besides,"
Britt the Elder said,
"we've gone to the future to check, and the plan is already working. All instances of the file are locked down. Now we just have to live up to our end and do the locking."
Britt the Elder stopped, as if something important had just occurred to her.
"That's what's bothering you, isn't it?"
she asked.
"The fact that the plan seemed to go into effect before we did anything to make it happen, except decide we would do it, it flies in the face of your free will fetish."
"For the record," Philip seethed, "it didn't go into effect the instant we decided to enact the plan. It went into effect the instant you told us about the plan. The fact that they all later decided to go along with it is incidental. And while I'm setting the record straight, my love of and belief in the simple truth of personal free will does not now, nor will ever, meet the clinical definition of a fetish."
"Well, in any case," Britt the Elder said, "I can see now why it upsets you so."
"No, you can't, because that's not the biggest problem with your plan. The biggest problem is the moral problem."
"If the problems were Voltron, the moral problem would be his torso,"
Martin added, trying to be helpful.
"I don't know what that is,"
Philip said, letting Martin know that he had failed.
It's like we've built a nice treehouse, climbed up into the treehouse, and now we're pulling the ladder up behind us, because if we don't, someone we don't like might come in.
Britt the Younger squeezed Philip's hand and said,
You're right, Philip. You are. No one denies that. The problem is that she's right, too. Actually, you're all three right. Martin's Voltron analogy was quite apt.
Thank you,
said Martin.
The file has been a tremendous benefit to those of us who found it,
Britt the Younger told Philip,
and it feels horribly selfish to deny that to the rest of humanity. But if we don't take steps to control it, the file will be used for evil again.
Philip said,
But it's already been used for evil, several times. And besides, we're just as likely to use it for evil in the future as anyone else.
Exactly,
Gwen said.
That horse has already left the barn. We can't undo the damage that's already been done. We can only try to prevent more from happening.
There might be ways to undo things. We are time travelers,
Philip protested. Gwen asked Philip,
Are you, of all people, about to suggest that we should go back in time and prevent ourselves from finding the very thing that allows us to go back in time? Philip, you know better than that. That's the kind of thing Martin would suggest.
Martin started to argue, but then decided it was unwise. Why start an argument with Gwen when things were going so well? And she did have a point. Philip stopped arguing, but he was clearly unconvinced.
Okay, okay. We've been through this already, I know. The summit debated this for 2 days. It just feels wrong to me, that's all. The file, it's bigger than any of us. It belongs to the whole world. Arguably, it is the whole world. Who are we to try to tell others they can't have it?
Britt the Elder said,
We're the ones who found it, who had the imagination to see how it could be used, and who have the responsibility to make sure that it's used wisely.
Philip said,
I don't know that you'll ever convince me of that.
You're right,
Britt the Elder said. At every summit after this, you move that we lift the password protection and get voted down.
Eventually, we make it part of the opening ceremony.
Philip smiled weakly.
Wonderful.
Martin laughed.
Cheer up, man. Look at it this way. With all of the known instances of the file password protected, we know Jimmy can never weasel his way back into the past to seek revenge.
We knew that already,
Philip said, his mood lifted by the memory.
We've fixed him, but good. Yes, sir, we can all rest easy knowing that we'll never see Jimmy again.
With that, Philip and Martin started the familiar leaving ritual. They said their goodbyes, then talked for several minutes. Then they re-said their goodbyes, then talked for several more minutes. Everyone had a good laugh at how silly they were being. Then they talked for several more minutes. Finally, they all got serious. Gwen hugged both men, hugging Martin noticeably longer, then said,
I'll see you both soon.
You will?
Philip asked, confused.
Yeah, I'm coming out to visit Martin. Please keep it quiet. I don't know how the locals would react if they knew the witch was returning.
Britt the Younger shook Martin's hand, then kissed Philip goodbye. She said,
I'll miss you.
Britt the Elder said,
So will I.
Philip sighed.
You know, I still don't buy into the idea that you two are the same person.
Britt the Elder touched Philip's cheek.
I know, Philip. I know.
Philip asked,
Do I ever?
Britt the Elder fought back a small laugh.
Philip,
she asked,
if I'm not the future version of Britt, how would I know the answer to your question?
Then she kissed him on the cheek. While Philip was working through his irritated silence, Martin took the initiative. He tipped his hat, said,
Ladies,
and teleported himself and Philip back home to medieval England. They materialized in Philip's rumpus room.
Here we are, Martin said. 2 weeks later, I can hardly wait to hear about all of the nothing that happened while we were gone.
Philip said,
It's just less confusing to keep track of things this way. I never liked returning to places the instant after I time-traveled out. It never felt quite right to go away and come back without really having left. Besides, if anything interesting happened while we weren't around, we can always go back and be there for it.
Martin shook his head.
And for us, that's what passes for less confusing.
Awesome.
Philip put down his suitcase, sat in his easy chair, and said,
So, Gwen's coming to visit you, eh?
Martin smiled and said, Yeah. He may have even blushed slightly. He sat on Philip's couch and tried to avoid eye contact, instead staring at the Gorf machine. Philip persisted.
And by visit you, we mean...
We mean visit me. She's coming for a visit, and the last thing I need is anybody insinuating that I claimed anything else is going to happen.
Okay,
Philip said, smiling.
Seriously, Martin said.
Sure,
Philip agreed.
No, seriously, Philip, Martin said, locking eyes with him. I mean it. We need to be clear on this. She's just coming for a visit. That's all it is.
Philip studied Martin's face for a moment, then said,
Really? That's it, huh?
Yeah, Martin said, leaning back.
Things are good, but we're going to take things slow. It turns out Gwen's a little old-fashioned.
No,
Philip said.
I see. Well, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah,
Martin said.
I guess.
Philip said,
Well, since you've opened up to me, I might as well tell you that Britt and I have a date next Saturday.
Who's Saturday? Yours or hers?
Time travelers have to think about these things.
And which Britt?
The younger, of course. And her Saturday, but at my place. I'm going to bring her to the rumpus room. Show her my Fiero.
Martin said, That all sounds filthy. They laughed. Then Philip said,
Yeah, Britt's not old-fashioned.
Martin groaned and said, Okay.
She's quite progressive, in fact.
Martin said, Ew.
Yes, ew.
Philip agreed. They sat for a moment, Martin shaking his head in disgust, Philip nodding his head in delight. Finally, Philip stood up, clapped his hands together, and said,
I'm gonna pop downstairs. Make sure the place is still standing.
Martin stood as well, saying,
I should go to my place and do the same.
They grunted a cursory farewell, more a see you later than a goodbye. Then Martin touched the handle of his suitcase, said the magic words, and the next second he was standing in his warehouse as if he'd never left. Martin breathed deeply, savoring the sensation of being home and alone. Martin and Philip enjoyed each other, but they had been in close proximity for the better part of 2 weeks. Martin wasn't quite sick of Philip, but he was getting close, and he knew that there was a better-than-average chance that Philip had had enough of Martin. Martin dragged his suitcase over to the work table and started to unpack his computer, when he heard the chime that meant another wizard was trying to contact him.
That's weird, Martin thought. Nobody knows I'm home but Philip.
Martin lifted his hand in front of his face. A small, semi-transparent image of Philip's head appeared in the palm of his hand.
Really?
Martin said. You miss me already?
Have you found your invitation?
Philip's head asked.
No, what are you talking about?
Go look under your front door,
Philip's head said.
I'll wait.
An envelope was waiting on the floor just inside Martin's warehouse, as if it had been slid under the door. Martin reached down and picked up the envelope. He tried to open it, but found it awkward with Philip's miniature floating head hovering in his hand.
Sorry, Martin said. I'm gonna have to hang up on you to see what it says.
Philip said,
Don't bother. If it's like mine, it says that they're giving your former apprentice Roy his dinner and trials tonight at the castle.
Huh, well, that's convenient.
Yeah,
Philip said.
They probably held it for us. They knew we'd be back today.
Martin said,
True. Waiting for us gave them time to plan something special.
36. The ability to teleport made distance irrelevant, so it was not a surprise that Philip got to the castle before Martin, even though Philip lived very far away, while Martin could see the castle from his front door. As Martin walked across the cavernous grand hall of the Castle Camelot, with its gold trim, gold statues, and marble floors with gold inlay, he was struck by how cheap it looked compared to even the simplest dwelling in Atlantis. The reason for this, of course, was that the castle was designed by Jimmy, specifically for the purpose of looking expensive, and just like a truly powerful person never needs to tell people that they are powerful, a truly rich person doesn't need to demonstrate that they are rich. The wizards were already seated at the banquet table, just as they had been at the last trial's banquet, which, as it happened, had been Martin's. That evening, Martin, as the guest of honor, had sat at the head of the table, next to the chairman, Jimmy, at the time. Philip had sat at the far end with Jeff, Gary, and the Magnuses, and the rest of the wizards had worked out a sort of self-created seating chart, sorting themselves in order of their own obsequiousness. Now things were different. Roy, the guest of honor, sat at the head of the table. Philip was the chairman and was already sitting to Roy's right. Jeff, Roy's trainer, sat across from Philip, and the rest of the wizards were seated around the table, almost randomly, except for the Magnuses, who still sat at the far end of the table, because that's what they were used to. Everyone wanted to hear about Martin and Philip's trip to Atlantis. Philip said that he would write up an official report of all the business that got done, which he would distribute as soon as it was done.
Good, Martin thought. We don't want to turn this into a debate about locking down the file. That's not what tonight's about. This is Roy's initiation.
It struck Martin that it would also be the last initiation.
All the more reason to let everyone enjoy it, he thought.
Philip and Martin took turns describing the city and its architecture, and ignoring questions about the sorceresses and their architecture. After a few minutes of this, Philip said that all of the details would be in his report, and shifted the focus back to Roy, who entertained the wizards with tales of what it was like to work at the Lockheed Skunk Works, which might not sound interesting to many people, but to this crowd it was endlessly fascinating. Eventually dinner was over, and Philip proclaimed that it was time to see Roy demonstrate his macro. It was how the trainee demonstrated his mastery over the shell program, and gave the other wizards an idea of what kind of behavior they could expect from the new guy. Fireballs, whirlwinds, and explosions were par for the course. But if the trainee did anything genuinely dangerous in an attempt to impress them, it would give the wizards something to think about. Before Roy could respond, Gary raised his hand and cleared his throat. Something about it unnerved Martin.
I don't know why, Martin thought. He's being perfectly polite.
Then Martin realized,
that's why it seems odd. Gary's being polite.
Gary said,
guys, before we get to Roy's macro, Eddie and I have a surprise for you.
Everybody looked to Philip, and Philip looked weary. Gary enjoyed surprising people, but he favored the kind of surprise that you announced afterwards by laughing, pointing, and yelling, gotcha. The fact that he was announcing a surprise in advance was out of character, and that led Philip to believe that Gary's surprise probably wouldn't be anything too bad. After all, he was already announcing the surprise in a manner that was out of character. The surprise would likely be out of character as well, meaning it might be something pleasant. Eddie wasn't a natural leader, but he was a born organizer. Nobody would ever follow him into battle, but at his word, they'd happily form a single-file line once they were there. When Eddie asked the wizards to step into the vast, empty portion of the room and form a circle, they did so with little hesitation.
Oh,
Eddie added as an afterthought.
And leave your stash at the table. You need your hands free.
There were only 24 of them, so the circle was not particularly large. Martin was reminded of P.E. class in elementary school, when they'd play with the parachute. Once the circle was formed, Gary said,
okay, now everybody join hands.
Nobody moved. Philip turned to Eddie and asked,
do we have to?
Eddie said,
yes.
With some grumbling, they all joined hands. Martin's left hand held Tyler's. His right held Gary's hand, who also held hands with Philip, who also held hands with Eddie, who craned his neck around to look at everybody's hands.
Okay,
Eddie said.
Looks like we're ready to go.
He and Gary made eye contact, nodded, then in unison said,
all is prepared.
There was a modest-sized flash of light, a small cloud of black smoke, and then Jimmy was standing in the middle of the circle with his hands clasped behind his back. With his green and gold wizard hat covering most of his gray hair, and his old wizard robe obscuring his gaunt, wiry frame, he was instantly recognizable. Philip spoke for everybody. Or rather, he shouted random noises in inarticulate alarm and rage for everyone. He struggled to get his hands free so that he could attack his nemesis, but he could not, as Gary and Eddie had a firm grip on them. As the three men struggled against each other, Gary grunted,
"This is why we needed to hold hands."
All of the wizards, save for Gary and Eddie, were shocked. The air was full of questions, obscenities, and obscenities stated in the form of questions.
"How?"
Martin shouted as he tried desperately to pry his other hand out of Gary's grip. He tried letting go of Tyler so he could use his